honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a program focusing on the Holocaust today in the wake of President Trump honoring survivors and liberators at his State of the Union this week. We've heard from dozens of veterans over the years here who ended up witnessing things they couldn't even have imagined at the concentration camps set up by the Nazi regime across Europe in the 1940s. There's only one episode of this show, however, that has ever been requested by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. That was the story of Dr. Oscar Cully Rice, who in his later years was a pioneering scientist who even contributed to the development of the PSA test for prostate cancer. He grew up in Germany in a Jewish family and experienced the increasing persecution of Hitler's reign firsthand.
I went to Altes Real Gymnasium, which is the same thing as a high school, but much more advanced. By the way, I think Albert Einstein went to the same school.
Oh, really?
High school. So until Hitler gave in the full power, till 35, 36, there was no problem go to the school. But the Hitler Youth started to really harass me, us, the Jewish people. In wintertime, they throw snowballs at us that had rocks in it. And I went to school in a bicycle. They were in the air out of the bicycle, ruining the bicycles too. And then one of the Hitler Youth that sat behind me was carrying a long knife, stick the knife in my back and said, when there were tests, especially math tests, where I was very good at, let's change tests.
Wow.
So my mother, father said, you got to get out of here. So I applied both for a visa to the United States and for a visa to go to Palestine.
Uh-huh.
And I had a very close friend, high school friend, which played chess. When I got the visa to come to the United States, I wanted to go with him, of course. But my mother says, you're going to the United States. So at 17, in those days, you don't disagree with your parents.
Well, yeah, but they're telling you it's not safe for you here. You have to go to America. You don't speak any English.
Yeah.
So you're sailing across the Atlantic Ocean.
But she knew where I was going because her aunt, who sponsored me, had connections with the ag school I went to.
An ag school that's now called Delaware Valley
University.
What you studied there was how to be a dairyman, right?
Well, that was my major. I also learned how to do other work, like to plow fields and spray orchard. They had five different departments.
Uh-huh.
What helped me with my English was the head of floriculture had got his degree from Heidelberg University and was fluent in German.
Uh-huh.
So as long as I was with him in the department, he helped me with my language.
So you picked up English pretty quick.
Yes. In 6 months, it was all right.
So you're over here. Your whole family is still in Germany. You're studying at this basically agricultural school, National Farm School it was called then. You end up getting out of there and running a dairy. But over this time period, how often did you hear from your family back home?
Very rarely, very rarely.
You had to be concerned about him, knowing what Hitler was about.
Of course. Then I asked my aunt to also give him visas, and she applied for it. But by the time the mail got to my parents, the American embassy in Stuttgart had closed because of the war, and there was nothing to be done anymore. That she couldn't do anything anymore.
And if your parents had waited a year, 2 years longer, you might not have made it to America.
Right.
But your little sister did.
Yeah, because we had relatives in Alsace-Lorraine, and they sent my sister, after the war has broken out, to Alsace-Lorraine. And then she went to southern France, around Marseille somewhere, and came to the United States.
Yeah, so here you've graduated from this university, and now you're running a dairy farm in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C. In fact, you're delivering 250 gallons of milk into Washington, D.C., so I'm sure Congress loved you. And you did that for a couple years. They didn't need you for the war. They needed you in that job. And then when you decided that you might want to get in this war and go fight the man who's persecuting your family and so many others, they said, no, you can't. You're an enemy.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's happened to your family, right?
Right. Absolutely no idea.
But by 1943, they decide, oh, we changed our mind. You go into the Army. You're training.
Fort McCown.
So you're out there shooting a machine gun?
Yeah.
And what did they do? They had you change targets real fast or something?
Yeah.
And they noticed how good you were at that?
Yeah.
Because you were real sharp in math. You could make the adjustments. Yeah. And so then they came to talk to you?
Yeah.
And they heard your accent?
Yeah.
What happened then?
Well, he said, we need you in Germany.
He realized you spoke German?
Yeah, fluent German. He says, we need you in Germany.
And he meant right then?
Right there. And he says, we can't send you because you're not a citizen. We got to make you a citizen.
So how'd they do that?
Well, they took me to the courthouse in Anniston, Alabama. The colonel went to see the judge and explained the situation to him. After I filled out all the forms, I went into the in the judge's chamber. And the judge looked at me and says, do you know anything about the Constitution? And I waved my pamphlet the Army had given me and says, yes, I've read it. And he said, you're a citizen.
Just like that.
And 3 weeks later, I was in Germany.
So they put you in the 79th Infantry Division.
Yeah.
You got there right as the Battle of the Bulge is going on,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. We were protecting the right flank of Patton's in the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, you had grown up in Germany. I know. I'm sure you'd had some rough winters.
Oh, yeah.
But what was that like, that winter of 44?
Digging a foxhole was terrible. It wasn't nice, let me put it this way. But I managed all right. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, I told all my companions to not call me Oscar, my first name, because it's so Germanic. I used my middle name, Carly. Then I could overhear a lot of the German conversations, which helped us so strategically.
So if you had gone by Oscar, the enemy would have been tipped off and wouldn't have spoken German so freely.
Yeah.
But you're in a combat situation.
Oh, yeah. We would get attacked by tanks and all this sort of thing.
And how often? I mean, here you are.
Yeah.
You're back in Europe. You're so close to your family, in theory.
Yeah.
But you still don't know what's happened to them.
Right.
How often did you think about that?
Oh, constantly, of course.
And you're fighting this regime that is the reason you left Germany.
Well, yeah. That had something to do with my motivation. I rewarded the Silver Star.
You mentioned the Silver Star. So this takes place long after the Battle of the Bulge, after you guys, by hook or by crook, made it across the Rhine, which wasn't easy for you. And you're in a foxhole looking out. And what do you see?
I see movement where I know what people. And in the foxhole, I know it was on the German side, so it must have been Germans.
And how far away were they?
About 100 yards.
And how many of them were there?
Well, actually, two. The army said three, but there was only two.
And what did you decide to do?
I decided to take my radio off and crawl in a ditch with my carbine that took me within, maybe 5 feet of that foxhole and got out, cocked my carbine first, of course, jumped out of the foxhole and told them the Germans to surrender.
And you said that in German?
In German, yeah.
Yeah.
And they immediately surrendered. There was no, didn't have to do anything. While I was in the front line with glasses watching what was going on, that's when, I suppose, it could have been a mortar shell from our side, but I don't think so. I think it was a mortar shell that the Germans.
And where did it hit?
Right behind me.
How close?
Oh, probably less than 10 feet.
Less than 10 feet. So you get shrapnel in your legs and in your rear end.
Yeah, but mostly in the radio.
Mostly in the radio.
Yeah.
So when you got the Silver Star, you'd left the radio behind in your foxhole.
Yeah.
Good thing you had it on your back this time.
Right. Absolutely right.
What do you think would have happened if you weren't wearing that radio?
I'd be dead.
Because that shrapnel would have gone right through your rib cage and into all your internal organs.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Right.
Did it take you a minute to figure that out? To figure out what kind of shape you were in?
Oh, yeah. And I called for the medic. The medic gave me some morphine and says, go back to the first aid station.
And how long did it take you to recover?
About 3 weeks.
When you're in that situation, does that thought enter your mind? Wow, that could have been me?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I just think of everything that you've accomplished in your life since the war. None of these things would have ever happened.
Right.
And there's a lot of chemistry and medicine innovations that have occurred because you're still alive. So they let you out of the hospital.
Yeah, to Rebo.
But you recognize something.
Yeah, a truck from our battalion, the big trucks that were marked B Battalion, 79th Infantry Division.
What'd you do?
Well, I talked to the driver, and he said, get in, I'll take you. back to your battalion.
You didn't have orders for that, though.
No. I was AWL on paper, but the colonel took care of it.
And this is the colonel who you'd had a long-standing relationship with.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one that wanted you over there because of your German skills. So what happened from there?
We went across Germany pretty easily. We didn't have to do much fighting and landed up in Czechoslovakia near the city of Marienbad. After a week or two, the colonel got orders to join the 1st Division in Nuremberg, and the colonel called Ike and had me transferred with him, essentially. It was separate. He went first, but just a couple of days later.
And up until this point, have you gotten any clues to what happened to your family?
No, not until I went to Munich to the headquarters where all the records were kept and looked at the records. And I found out later the records were not accurate.
Well, I want to understand what this was like for you. And again, keeping in mind that you're still a very young man. So you're ordered to Nuremberg, and they're going to have you interrogate war criminals because you speak such great German.
Yeah.
Now, these are the war criminals that wanted to kill you and any other Jew they could find.
Yeah.
But to that point, you were okay with that idea.
I was hesitant even then.
Yeah.
You shouldn't say. I was not ready to tell my colonel no.
Sure.
But after seeing the records.
So tell me about this. So you go to Munich, and what's in Munich?
All the records are kept in Munich.
And you mean all the records from the entire Holocaust?
Yeah. They were later transferred to another place, and any correction were made. The Holocaust Museum in Washington put me up to that, to go to the records at the other place, to make sure. Like they had, my parents were loaded in a cattle train, and in Munich it said they were taken to Riga, Latvia, executed there, but the train never made it to Riga. It stopped.
What I want to understand is what knowledge you are receiving at the time. Because you get to Munich, and here is this vast trove of records. Was it a needle in a haystack to find your family in there?
No, no. It was filed under my regular name, Rice.
So you look up Rice.
Yeah.
And as you get to that spot, is your heart pounding a little bit? Or did you think you already knew what you were going to find?
I think I knew what I was going to find. I had enough stories. When we went across from the Rhine to Czechoslovakia, we were very close to the Belsen concentration.
Bergen-Belsen,
Bergen-Belsen. And there, you know, in the army, rumors fly. We knew that it was very bad.
But now you're opening up a file.
Yeah.
And you see right there, and it has your parents' name.
Yeah, it's in here. The only thing that was wrong is that it didn't go to Riga. The gate went to Kaunas.
But you're looking at a paper that says your parents are dead.
Yeah, and my grandparents. My grandparents went to Theresienstadt.
And what about your brother?
Oh, he went with my parents.
What did that do to you, to see that in print?
Oh, it's hard to take, let's put it this way. If I would have had a German that was bothering me, I might have shot him, without question.
So you find out that your parents, your grandparents, your brother are all victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're also thinking at some point, that's what would have happened to me.
Sure.
Yet you go back to Nuremberg, and they still expect you to interrogate these guys.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
I told the colonel I couldn't do it emotionally, and he understood.
I think we all understand. That is Dr. Oscar Rice, who told me very simply what he thinks of people who try to deny or minimize the Holocaust 3/4 of a century later. They're idiots, he said. You can see that on video online. We're out of time today, but thanks for following me down this path the State of the Union set in motion this week. Remember to link to each one of these veteran stories at hometownheroesradio.com. And remember all those victims, like Oscar Rice's family, whose legacy is the caution, the vigilance, the resolve to never let anything like that happen again. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.